This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The debate over torture and America's image abroad. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. On her tour of Europe, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is confronted at every stop with questions about secret CIA prisons, the use of airspace to transfer prisoners from country to country, and torture. Meantime, in Washington, debate continues over what is permissible for the treatment of prisoners in the war on terror. On To the Point, is America using other countries to get around the ban against torture? Do those governments know it? Are exceptions needed against a lawless enemy, or does torture inspire more acts of terror? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the death penalty. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. As Condoleezza Rice tours Europe, debate about torture continues in Washington. On To the Point, does the war on terror justify exceptions to the ban on inhumane treatment? Is the Bush administration using other countries to get around its own laws? On Reporter's Notebook, should Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger spare the life of a man who founded a criminal gang? We'll hear about divided opinions among African Americans in California. First, this news update. In the second of three speeches designed to bolster support for the war in Iraq, President Bush said today that the cities of Mosul and Najaf are being transformed from bloody battlefields into examples of progress.
In places like Mosul and Najaf, residents are seeing tangible progress in their lives. They're gaining a personal stake in a peaceful future, and their confidence in Iraq's democracy is growing. The progress of these cities is being replicated across much of Iraq. And more of Iraq's people are seeing the real benefits that a democratic society can bring.
The president was speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. David, as always, welcome.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be back with you.
What was new about this speech?
Well, a couple of things. First, it's the first time that we've ever heard the president admit outright that they made very major mistakes in the rebuilding of Iraq, just as he admitted some fairly small mistakes in countering the insurgency in his speech last week in Annapolis. He said explicitly that they started off with big infrastructure projects, you know, big electricity, big water projects, big oil and gas projects, and that was a mistake because they take too long. They don't show signs of progress, and of course, they are giant targets for the insurgents. So he talked about a change of strategy there. At the same time, as you mentioned, he discussed Najaf and Mosul as two examples of rebuilding success or potential success. We've had reporters in those cities in recent times. The center of Najaf is still totally shattered. Mosul is one of the most dangerous cities in Iraq to this day because it's strongly divided between the ethnic and religious groups. So those are examples that, you know, I think one might say are at best works in progress.
Talking with David Sanger, the White House correspondent for the New York Times. Another thing that was different today, it seems to me, was the audience. It was the Council on Foreign Relations. This was not a military base or a high school gym with selected political supporters of the president. How did the council, a bunch of experts on foreign policy, respond to his speech?
Well, you know, the usual tradition at council events, and I go to many of them, is that there's a question and answer session. The White House said that they were going to skip that tradition today, and so there really were no ways for the members to ask the president about the speech or the previous one. He got what I guess I would call a friendly but tepid reaction. There was no wild applause at any moment, the way there had been in Annapolis, where the audience were the midshipmen in Annapolis. The White House is clearly sensitive to the criticism that they have been picking their audiences with care, and I think this was partly an effort to show that he was willing to go into territory that was not necessarily friendly.
We also had, in some contrast to what you called a tepid response, an angry response from some Democrats, particularly Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House, who said that the security situation on the ground is not better, as the president said. Do you think he made any progress with critics of the war?
Well, you know, I think that he makes some significant progress just by admitting that there were errors made early on, because at least then they can get to a common ground about what they need to do. The old position they were in, which was we've done this just right, and not admitting changes of strategy even after they've made them, puts them in a difficult position in talking to their critics, because they do not have a way at that moment of indicating, you know, what the common ground is for going forward. At the same time, there hasn't been very much money spent. There are things he didn't say, Warren, that I thought were quite important. Foreign nations, I think, pledged upwards of $13 billion or so for reconstruction. Very little of that has been delivered. He didn't discuss what is probably the hottest political issue in Iraq, which is whether or not the government should end subsidies for oil, food, electricity, things like that. The only thing he said was that the country needed to move more rapidly to a free market.
Just a couple of seconds left, but do you think that he will succeed in getting a new emphasis on the rebuilding process, on the projects that he mentioned today, in your own paper or elsewhere in the media?
Well, he may. Certainly each of these speeches it gets widely reported. We try to report all of what he said. We put his full text up on our website. We also write stories that go back and assess the examples he's picked versus what our reporters have seen when they've been in those areas, and try to indicate those areas where their reporting matches up with the president's assessment, and tries to point out differences as well. I think in the polls as well, you're beginning to see him bounce back a little bit. A number of polls I've seen in recent days suggest that he's begun to inch up from those lows he had a few weeks ago.
Okay, David Sanger, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
White House correspondent for The New York Times. In a moment, the debate over torture and America's image abroad on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Republican John McCain got 90 votes in the Senate for a blanket ban on cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of prisoners, even in the war on terror. President Bush has threatened his first veto unless the CIA is exempt from that language. In the Weekly Standard magazine, syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer has written that torture is a terrible and monstrous thing, as degrading and morally corrupting to those who practice it as any conceivable human activity. But he also argues that torture is the moral duty of political leaders under two very specific circumstances. Mr. Krauthammer, welcome back to our program.
Pleasure to be with you.
Tell us about those two circumstances.
Well, they're colloquially known first as the ticking time bomb. Classic case ethics 101, a guy's got a nuclear weapon in Manhattan, it's going to go off in 3 hours. You catch the guy who planted it, he knows where it is, he's not talking. It seems to me there's nobody with any moral reasoning in any moral calculus who would say that you cannot do anything you need to him to save a city. That would be number one. It's an extreme case, but there are obviously gradations. Let's say you knew about the bomb in the Chechnya school with only 250 children, and you found the guy who was planning the attack, and he knew where it was going to happen, and you could stop it. So that's the ticking time bomb. And that's the easy case, the easy exception. The second, which is a little more difficult and a little more nuanced, is what I would call the high-value, slow-fuse suspect. I'm thinking, for example, of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy, the architect of 9/11, captured in Pakistan, being held, we think, in one of those secret black sites. He knows the logistics. He knows about cells. He knows identities. He knows plans. He knows all kinds of things about future attacks, not necessarily an imminent attack. And the question is, what can you do to him? And, of course, there's a whole level of what you might call everything from psychological pressure on the one hand to outright torture on the other. it's clear to me that in a circumstance like that, where you know you will save some life, not perhaps imminently, but you will make a huge advance in saving lives in the war on terror by interrogating people like him, that you can use a lot more than what you could use on a prisoner in an American prison. In American prison, you're not allowed to touch a hair on the head of that prisoner. Here we're talking about specifically getting information of that sort. And it ranges all the way from sleeplessness on the one hand, which is sort of the softest, if you like, to the other extreme is what's called waterboarding, where you give a sensation of drowning, which is a terrible kind of treatment. And yet we know from ABC and the CIA sources that was used on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and within 2.5 minutes he started talking. And we know also that because of the capture of him and many other high-level al-Qaeda operatives, we've gotten information. No one knows exactly what's in that information. But I would argue it's no accident that we have not been attacked after 9/11 for over 4 years, when there's not a person in the country who thought that we would go 3 months, 6 months, or a year without a second attack. So these are the two exceptions in which I think we have to think about cruel and human and degrading treatment, and in which I think it would simply be a terrible mistake to rule out anything of that category when there are human and innocent lives at stake.
Charles Krauthammer, again, syndicated columnist and contributing editor to the Weekly Standard magazine. Abraham Sofer is senior fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, specializes in international diplomacy and national security, was legal advisor to the State Department from 1985 to 1990, and presented the Torture Convention to the U.S. Senate in 1990. Mr. Sofer, thank you for joining us today.
Fine.
Do you think that there should be any exceptions, and that would you rule out the two that Charles Krauthammer says we should at least talk about?
Well, I rule them out as legal exceptions, absolutely. There are no exceptions to the Torture Convention. It's a treaty. We entered into it. It's the law of the land, and it's been implemented by a criminal law. And anyone who violates it is guilty of a crime. So, no, there's no exceptions. On the other hand, Charles is absolutely right, and so is John McCain, when he says you have to do what you have to do. And while Charles is critical of that kind of an exception, which you call really the emergency doctrine, it really is a very well-recognized doctrine in philosophy and American law. It started with John Locke. It was reiterated by Madison, applied by Abraham Lincoln. And when Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, he didn't claim he had the right to do it. He admitted that it was illegal, and he did it because he had to do it. And the Congress approved what he did. It is very, very dangerous to approve exceptions to torture because of the very things that Charles says happens when you have rules that allow torturing. You get every sadist in the world that comes out of the woodwork to be the torturers, and you just can't control it. These things get delegated down, and they embarrass us. And I just challenge Charles or anyone to tell me about a regime and a leadership that engaged in torture that's well remembered in history.
There are many questions raised here, obviously, thanks to Abraham Sofer. We'll come back to you in a minute, Sofer, rather. Charles Krauthammer, that question to you, then. Can you think of an example where torture has, in fact, resulted in a conclusion that all would agree was the right one?
Well, let me give you a test case. It's a real case. It's not even hypothetical. And by the way, I want to preface this by saying that I respect Abe. We're old friends from long ago, even from the Reagan days, and I really admire him. But I find it hard to understand his position, which is that he recognizes that these exceptions are legitimate, and they ought to be acted upon the same way that Lincoln suspended habeas corpus in contravention of the Constitution, and yet he wants it to remain illegal. It seems to me to be incoherent. Either you believe these things ought never be done, or you don't. If you believe it ought never be done, then you can never do it. If you believe it ought to be done,
then I think it's our only question is whether you admit it honestly or whether you pretend that you don't.
Before we get to that other question, then, let me ask Mr. Sofer to respond to that. What about it? Is this incoherent? The same criticism is made by Mr. Krauthammer of Senator McCain and his amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill.
The exception that he's trying to draw, Charles, and I do respect and admire his work very, very much and agree with him on almost everything he writes. But on this, he's just wrong. His standard is really unmanageable. It would apply morally to every domestic criminal. He gives an example in his article about Nachson Waxman, who was kidnapped by Palestinian terrorists, and he praises the fact that the Israeli armed forces tortured or used coercive interrogation beyond their guidelines to find out where he was and almost saved him. Well, I mean, I don't think they did the wrong thing. They did an illegal thing. Rabin recognized they did an illegal thing, and he pardoned them because under the circumstances, it was an appropriate thing. But to allow people to do that kind of thing in some kind of a codification would apply to every crime. The life of a soldier is no more valuable than the life of a civilian. The life of 10 civilians is no less valuable in principle than the life of 100 civilians. So there's no limit to where the principle that he's espoused will take you. And we thought these issues through during the drafting of the torture convention. And the states involved unanimously rejected, during the Reagan administration, the approach of creating exceptions, because we saw that every tyrant in the world always regards, and sometimes quite sincerely regards, what he's doing as an exception, and that he is saving Christianity or Islam or whatever. They find something that carries them away in the good faith belief that they truly are saving something worthwhile, and they engage in these things. And that is why the torture convention specifically says that there shall be no recognized exceptions.
So you say there's no exception in law, but in practice, if in fact the extraordinary circumstances Mr. Krauthammer outlined occur, then people behave as they will, and you adjudicate the matter later. Is that what you're saying?
That is what 140 states have signed on to.
Okay, Mr. Krauthammer, back to you, your response, and then tell us, if you will, if you can have an if there is an example of a place where torture has worked and been recognized as beneficial.
Well, I want to thank Abe for bringing up on his own the example that I was about to raise. That was a clear example of torture, the Nachson case, the Nachson-Waxman case, where the prime minister, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, incidentally, admitted that they used torture to find out where the soldier was being held. In a country that is under, constant terror attack and that has handled itself in an absolutely exemplary way in dealing with the kind of onslaughts that I don't think any other country on the planet would have dealt with such humanity and restraint. So that's to answer your question on the example of a country. But let me, in the interest of maybe advancing the argument rather than having simply a debate, try to see where Abe and I agree. We seem to agree that basically we have sort of the same understanding of what the exceptions are as to when you can go beyond what's allowed in law. It seems to me that perhaps our only difference here, and I think it may be the only difference I have with John McCain, is we all would act in the same way, but Abe would leave it as illegal and have a retroactive pardon, as happened in the Rabin case, whereas I would do it differently. I would have it codified in advance, and I was very specific in my article that codification would not be a blank check for anybody to go ahead and to act and to torture at will. I'm very specific that if we have these exceptions written in the law, it would have to be very specific, small group of trained interrogation specialists, no one else. I would not allow anybody in the military to engage in any of this anytime. It would have to be with written authorization from the highest officials in the land, meaning cabinet level, etc. So I'm not giving a blank check. So it seems to me that Abe and I perhaps agree it ought to be allowed, but the only question is, do you allow it by a retroactive pardon, or do you allow it by a codification in advance? And my question to Abe would be, when you have the prime minister or the Congress retroactively absolved through a pardon, they have to have a code, a codification, in order for them to know what actions retroactively judged here justified this kind of torture or not. So it isn't as if he escapes the problem of codification, as I think he implies he would. He doesn't. Each of us have that issue. I would do it in advance, and he would do it retroactively.
Mr. Sofer, how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, that's not the only thing on which we disagree here. I do disagree with Charles that every form of coercion is banned. I think there is not a blanket ban on all forms of coercion in the Torture Convention. There are many forms of coercion that are permitted, and the President and the Defense Department have analyzed that issue, and they've listed the kinds of things that can be done. And I think Charles overstates the extent to which the U.S. government and other governments are prevented from engaging in some forms of coercion. I also think Charles very dangerously understates the horrible things that can be done that are torture. You know, he very skillfully describes a person being subjected to water torture and some other forms of torture. But then he avoids dealing with the kind of shocking and horrendous forms of torture that you really have to deal with if you are going to create a legal exception. Can you just start burning people? Can you chop off body parts one by one? Can you do what the North Koreans are said to have done with American soldiers, expose them to naked women?
I'm going to interrupt in the interest of time. We're running short. Mr. Krauthammer, I do want to give you a chance to respond to that. What about it? Where do you draw the line, and how do you codify that?
Well, I try to make my case even harder by choosing waterboarding, which is the water torture, simply because in the literature I have read, CIA people who've been engaged in this area and who know it very well have all said that from their own perspective, that was the worst kind of torture imaginable because it gave a sense of drowning, and that the average CIA expert subjected to it in tests broke within an average of 15 seconds.
Well, what about chopping off limbs or
something? Well, I mean, look, obviously, I mean, I would not. If you want to make a catalog of things that you should never, ever do, I would say that's okay. It's not a problem, but it doesn't get away from the main issue. I've chosen a pretty extreme form of interrogation, which is not hypothetical, which we used on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which most people call torture. And the question is, if it gave us information within 2.5 minutes, should we or should we not allow our interrogators to use it?
Mr. Sofer, a quick answer if you can. We have 30 seconds.
Under the law, they are not permitted to engage in torture or acts of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And to the extent that that is such an act, it would be prohibited. But if you need to save lives, you sometimes have to take responsibility for such an extreme situation.
We're out of time. Thank you both. Abraham Sofer of the Hoover Institution, Charles Krauthammer, syndicated columnist. We'll be right back with more on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. As we've just heard, the debate over torture in Washington is going hot and heavy. Just heard two conservative voices with very different opinions on whether or not there ought to be any exceptions to the ban on torture. In Kyiv, Ukraine today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice clarified U.S. policy on the treatment of prisoners in the war on terror. She said no U.S. personnel may use cruel or degrading techniques of interrogation inside or outside American borders. Previously, the Bush administration had said the ban on inhumane treatment did not apply to Americans who were overseas. Glenn Kessler is diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. He's now in Brussels with Secretary Rice. And Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Does this appear to be a major shift in American policy, the application of the ban, whether or not American personnel are in or without the United States?
Yes, it's certainly the first time it's been publicly articulated. Apparently, a few weeks ago, Mr. Gonzalez, the Attorney General, sent a letter or sent an answer to a question to the Judiciary Committee, and it was buried. It was page 57, you know, answer to question 158, where he more or less said this, but the White House had never publicized it, and no one had ever really come out and really said it until Secretary Rice said it today. So it's certainly the first public articulation of this policy.
What are the consequences as far as her trip to Europe is concerned and all of the questions that she's been getting on the treatment of prisoners, on the secret CIA prisons that have been reported, and other issues as well?
Well, I think it will. It might help things. It's been a bit of a rough trip for the secretary. I mean, she left on Monday, releasing a rather lengthy statement trying to clarify U.S. policy. And this particular issue was one that kept coming up. And she's been questioned by European reporters as well as with the reporters traveling with her at every single stop that she's made in Berlin, in Bucharest, today in Kiev. In fact, right now she's having dinner with the foreign ministers of NATO. And the Dutch foreign minister went into it saying he was quite upset by her statement on Monday, didn't think it explained enough things, and he promised a lively discussion.
When she said today that no U.S. personnel may use cruel or degrading techniques of interrogation inside or outside American borders, does that leave the loophole having to do with what's referred to as extraordinary rendition? If a prisoner is moved to another country, taken in one country, moved to yet a third country by U.S. Personnel, would this not apply then to whatever happened to that person there and to the treatment that he or she was given by people of that country?
Well, no, it wouldn't necessarily apply. I mean, in her statement on Monday, she said they do their best efforts to get assurances that people will not be tortured when they're transferred to these third countries. One of the big issues for a lot of civil libertarians was that they were basically saying there was an opt-out for CIA personnel operating in these secret prisons overseas. So, you know, it's a step forward, according to these experts, for the administration to say it now applies to all U.S. personnel. Obviously, you can't have complete of control when people are sent to another country, though, of course, you might have an idea of what might happen if you're going to send them, say, to France versus Egypt.
I understand that Secretary Rice has refused to answer any questions about these alleged CIA prisons, saying that these are matters of national security and she can't address them in public. Has she conceded, as the new chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, suggested yesterday, that a mistake was made in the case of the German citizen who was arrested in the Balkans and taken then to Afghanistan? Has Secretary Rice conceded a mistake was made there?
Well, no. She spoke generally of the fact that when the United States makes mistakes, they try to rectify it. She wouldn't address that particular case, in part because it's in litigation. Merkel said that the administration had admitted it made a mistake, and that's a reference, I believe, to when Ambassador Dan Coats told the Germans that they had wrongfully abducted this man, and that happened in May of 2004. But they've never publicly said anything. And in terms of answering the questions, she has left on this trip broad hints that European governments knew what was going on and that they've been cooperating. You got the pretty good feel in that statement that she was suggesting as much as she could that these places existed, but it was an important part of the war on terrorism.
How has this debate, we just heard our next guests, I think, listen to it as well. You did not have a chance to do that, Glenn Kessler. But how does this debate in Washington over torture seem to be affecting the Secretary's credibility as she tries to clarify American policy in Europe?
Well, I'm not sure her credibility is on the line at the moment. She has done a lot here in Europe to rebuild relations in the past year. I think she may have put her credibility on the line today because, you know, the legal experts have often said that the administration has used tortured, you know, or played word games in trying to explain its policy. She made a very clear and explicit statement today that if it's later discovered that, no, in fact, even with these words, there was a loophole in there involving U.S. personnel or the CIA, then that would be very damaging for her.
Glenn Kessler, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
And now in Brussels, traveling with Secretary of State Rice, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. The Baroness Sarah Ludford is a liberal democratic European justice spokeswoman. She's a member of the European Parliament's Civil Liberties Commission, much concerned with the issues we've been talking about today. Ms. Ludford, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Warren.
You have been very skeptical about the administration, about Secretary Rice, I believe, as well. Do you think that today, particularly, she has succeeded in clarifying American policy to your satisfaction?
Well, she does appear to have announced a change in American policy, and to that extent, it's welcome if she is honestly saying that no U.S. personnel, including the CIA, are permitted to practice torture or cruel or inhumane treatment. That does appear to be a change of policy, and so from now on, one supposes that that is the policy of the Bush administration, in which case it appears to be a change. Glenn just referred to the word games we've been hearing in the past, and certainly it's been difficult to keep up with the carefully worded justifications for maltreatment and even amounting to torture in the past. So if she's now saying this is a clean break with what we have been doing, that is welcome. Although I still don't understand then why Cheney is charging round Congress trying to block the McCain amendment and wanting to exempt the CIA. Maybe I'm just a bit out of touch with what's going on there in Washington, but why is this bid until very recently then been to exempt the CIA from a ban on torture? Is that now dropped? Is the administration going to accept the McCain move? It's all still perhaps a little unclear.
Sarah Ludford is a member of the European Parliament's Civil Liberties Committee. We'll come back to her in a moment. First, we have Mark Dubowitz on the line, Attorney Chief Operating Officer for the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, organization that's supportive of the Bush administration. He also works closely with the European Foundation for Democracy, a partner organization based in Brussels. And Mark Dubowitz, thank you for being with us.
Nice to be here, Aaron.
Do you think that this does, in fact, represent a change in policy? Is it a way of saying that the CIA has not been, in fact, operating secret internment facilities for prisoners in Europe?
Well, first of all, Warren, I want to be clear. I'm certainly not a supporter of the Bush administration. I'm supporter of principles, and I think that it's a very important principle at stake here. So let's get down to the real question, which I think Charles and Abe Sofer were debating early in our program, and that's how best to balance the demand on our governments to protect the lives of our families from really genocidal jihadists with the need to protect our democratic values, and obviously these are values that we're fighting to protect. I think the problem has been that policy on this issue and the debate on this issue has been ambiguous, both from the administration and from its critics. It's been often hysterical from both sides. And I think Charles and Abe actually began to bring some good, moderate, reasonable debate in drawing lines. And I think this is all about drawing lines between how do we protect Americans and Europeans from the, genocidal jihadists. At the same time, how do we protect our values?
Well, then, what is the CIA doing and what's going on in Europe? What light can be shed on that with all of the suspicions that have been raised, hysterical or otherwise?
Well, I think, first of all, the critics often give the presumption of innocence to the terrorists, but often don't give the presumption of innocence to the American government. First of all, these secret prisons, or so-called secret prisons, are alleged to exist. Second of all, if they do exist, it's difficult to believe that the CIA could carry on operations in Europe without the knowledge of European governments and their respective intelligence services. As a result, they're not secret. Just because the public and the media has been out of the loop does not mean that it's actually secret. We all acknowledge that clandestine operations are a crucial ingredient in this war on terror, and I'm sure the Baroness would agree that the CIA, her MI5, etc., can't reveal every bit of information about every operation they're carrying out.
Mark Dubowitz of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Back to Sarah Ludford, our European Parliament member. How do you respond to that? And do you think that, in fact, the European governments have known what's going on? Do you find that the presumption of innocence is something that you have to suspend in this instance?
Well, yes, I'm afraid I do believe that all the indications point to a high degree of complicity by European governments, and that was essentially what Condoleezza Rice said on Monday, which doesn't, I'm afraid, come as a surprise. It did beg a belief that all these CIA flights, we're now talking around about 700 now have been documented, could have taken place without some official permission.
So, excuse me, now, with regard to the flights, that's the first time they have been mentioned, but the 700 flights involving prisoners taken in one country and then transferred to another country, flights over European airspace or landing at European airports, is that what you're talking about?
They were doing something, and the supposition from the Washington Post material, as much as anything, is that they might have been transporting terrorist suspects outside the law. But the problem is we don't know, and that's precisely what members of the European Parliament, like myself, are calling for, which is a proper investigation. And we are keeping up the pressure, calling our own governments to account, because they must have known at some level, whether governments or intelligence agencies, as was just said, MI5 and their counterparts, they must have known what was going on. Can I just go back, though? There's also the issue about this outsourcing. Condi Rice on Monday was very careful in what she said. She said, we don't deliver terrorist suspects where we believe they will be tortured. That left, of course, open the possibility that we might deliver them where we turn a blind eye to what's going to happen to them, which is equally unacceptable. I mean, if the U.S. has seized people, whether by kidnapping or another means, they are responsible for those people. And you can't just say, well, we delivered them to some Middle East regime, which is known, well documented, to practice torture, and say, well, nothing to do with us. I have to say, I'm afraid that I found that discussion between Charles and Abe earlier, I really couldn't distinguish a lot between their views. I don't agree with you that there was a great difference between them. And this sort of moral benchmark appears to have been eroded. And that makes me very sad about America's reputation and moral authority in the world. I mean, the ban on torture under the Convention Against Torture is absolute. That it's the one.
Well, Abraham Sofer said it was. Abraham Sofer said it was absolute.
Yes, but he said, "Well, it's okay. You know, if someone breaks it, well, then they can be pardoned or justified with hindsight." I couldn't see a great difference between that and saying, "Well, we'll have an exception in the law." I mean, unlike habeas corpus, for instance, there are very limited circumstances in which habeas corpus can be suspended, but the ban on torture is absolute. You can't have a little bit of toleration of torture. You know, if you tolerate a little, you tolerate a lot.
Okay.
And that's the problem that the U.S. has got into in the last 4 years. You know, where do you draw the line? Once you've breached the absolute ban, you really don't know where you are. You're in a moral quagmire, frankly.
Mark Dubowitz, what do you say to that statement? To continue the conversation that we had earlier, I do want to get back to the issue of the CIA detention centers and the overflights and so on. But how do you respond to what we just heard from Ms. Ludford?
Well, let's be very clear. When the U.S. government ratified the UN Convention, the Senate specifically limited it to judicial proceedings involving criminal defendants. And let's be very clear, judicial proceedings involving criminal defendants. The McCain Amendment is extending not only the definition of torture beyond the intentional infliction of severe physical or mental pain to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, but it wants to turn every enemy combatant into an honorable prisoner of war with essentially Geneva Convention protection, and in doing so, protect these terrorists against any type of coercive interrogation. So let's be very clear on what we're talking about when we talk about this convention on torture. The second thing is, democracies must fight a war against these genocidal jihadists with one hand tied behind their backs. I think we all agree that we need to protect our democratic values. But I'm wondering if the Baroness agrees that we should require our governments to fight with both hands tied behind our backs. I think this is bad policy. I think it's bad morality. I think we're in a strange situation right now where the U.S. government is permitted to kill bin Laden, Zarqawi, Zawahiri, or any terrorist leader with a Hellfire missile, and that killing is fine. But the U.S. government can't inflict non-lethal discomfort to obtain the intelligence necessary to do the killing. I think that's absurd. And I think what Charles and Abe were doing was trying to figure out a way to draw lines. And I think it's important that we need to distinguish between the cases that they raised, the ticking time bomb case, the high-value suspect case, or the low-value suspect case. We also need to draw lines between the type of coercive interrogation that's required. I think we all agree that intentional infliction of severe physical or mental pain or torture should not be allowed.
Okay, let me go back to Ms. Ludford, because we're running short of time, and ask you that question. What about the worst-case scenario that is raised by Charles Krauthammer, that you know that somebody is about to blow up a lot of people? Wouldn't you be justified in doing anything, including killing that person, in order to prevent that?
No. I mean, you asked them for an example. They came up with one single example. I think the experts tell us that, which makes sense, that sometimes people will tell you anything to stop the torture. So you can't, just for practical, pragmatic reasons, torture doesn't always produce useful information. But my main point really is about, you know, I can't understand Americans who call for, you know, the upholding of freedom and want to campaign for freedom and democracy in the world. And I would give three cheers for that. If America wasn't undermining its own credibility, our difference from Osama bin Laden is that we do uphold democracy and human rights and the rule of law. That's what allows us to say that he is so morally terrible and you know, using violence and using terrorist attacks. And because he hates the West, he hates what we stand for.
Okay, Mark Dubowitz, quickly, we're running short of time again. What about this, the descent to the level of the enemy? Isn't that what you're talking about?
I don't think we're descending to the level of the enemy. I think we're fighting this war with one hand tied behind our back, but this is not a suicide pact. We can't fight with both hands tied behind our back. It is clear that torture does not work, but waterboarding worked on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He gave up important information in 2.5 minutes.
So there's a definition of torture here that's involved. And some people say waterboarding is torture. You say it's not.
Well, I'm saying that there's a continuum that needs to be decided. My colleague at FDD, Andy McCarthy, has proposed a national security court, which would monitor the detention of terrorist captives. It would have experts. You could get a terrorism warrant. In other words, experts would determine, is the risk grave, is that the seriousness of the risk something that justifies a continuum of coercive interrogation.
So, Ms. Ludford, could you codify then, to use the term that appeared in our earlier conversation, exceptions to the ban on torture?
Well, no, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to be simplistic on this, but the ban is absolute.
Okay.
That's the whole point. And, you know, you're going to tie yourself in knots trying to justify exceptions to it.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that, and I apologize to both of you for that and to our listeners as well. We simply need to move on. We will come back to this conversation. Hope all of our guests will join us again in the future, because it is a controversy, obviously, that's not going away and won't go away, certainly in Europe, as long as Condi Rice is there trying to explain American policy. Thank you all. Mark Dubowitz with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Sarah Ludford with the European Parliament, and our earlier guests, Glenn Kessler, Abraham Sofer, and Charles Krauthammer as well. Good to have all of you on our program. Tomorrow in Sacramento, California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will hold a clemency hearing for Stanley Tookie Williams, who's been on death row for 25 years. Williams founded the Crips, a criminal gang that's terrorized Los Angeles and expanded to other cities, but he claims he's turned his own life around, and supporters say that makes him a role model who can persuade young people to reject a violent lifestyle. More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Mormon Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Legal appeals appear to have run out for Stanley Tookie Williams, but he still denies committing the four brutal murders that he was convicted of in 1981. One of the groups calling for his death sentence to be commuted to life without possibility of parole is the NAACP. But African Americans are by no means united in the appeal for clemency. Earl Ofari Hutchinson is a commentator in Los Angeles for New American Media. Earl, good to have you back on our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
When you advocated clemency, what kind of response did you get from your African-American readers?
Ooh, I have to tell you, I was overwhelmed. I assumed, like so many, the death penalty, so many African-Americans appear to be against it. We know all the reasons, race, class, bias, so forth, errors. I mean, it's been filled with that the last few years, mistaken identity, folk that have been killed, certainly executed, and later on found out that they didn't do it. So all of that has created a sense that African Americans are uniformly against the death penalty. When I came out for clemency, and I've been writing columns about it, speaking about it, first relatives, some friends, coworkers, associates, and then the emails came in saying, Earl, you know, we like a lot of the things that you say and do. We support a lot of your positions. We read your writings. We enjoy that. But on this one, we're not with you. We don't support clemency for Tookie Williams. So I had to tell you, Warren, I was really taken aback. I was really surprised not only at the number and quantity of responses, negative responses, but the vehemence of it. That's what struck me.
The argument in favor of Tookie Williams, and there have been Hollywood celebrities and others on this side of the issue, is that he has redeemed himself by turning his life around, by advocating to young people in a very public way to the extent that he can from death row, by writing children's books and in other ways, that they ought to stay out of gangs, that they ought not to choose that violent lifestyle. What's the argument that you hear against that?
Well, they turn all of that on its head and say precisely because he was part of that violent lifestyle, not just part of it, but as we well know, the founder of the Crips or co-founder of the Crips. So they simply say, look, for 30 years, poor black communities have suffered from murder, mayhem, gunplay, drive-by shootings, drug dealing, you name it, all the negative things that have taken so many lives, have made mothers and fathers, grandmothers, grandfathers, have made them without their children, have made them childless. And we also know, just the reverse of that, so many young African-American males and females have been gunned down, victims of this violence. So essentially, in their mind, Tookie Williams is the symbol of a lot of this murder, mayhem, and destruction. And I have to tell you, Warren, once you create that kind of symbol, this negative icon, it's relentless and unforgiving and unsparing. So that's what I'm getting.
Earl Ofari Hutchinson, once again, nationally syndicated columnist, also a radio host, a civil rights activist, author of many books, including The Crisis in Black and Black. When you wrote this and when you got that kind of response, did it change your mind?
No, because philosophically, morally, and pragmatically, I'm against the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Warren, it wouldn't make any difference whether it's Tookie Williams or the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. I don't think the state should be in the business of killing people,
okay,
period.
Well then, all right, then let's turn to the Williams case. Did it change your mind at all about the kind of arguments that are being used on his behalf?
No, what it did change my mind, well, it didn't change my mind, it did make me think that if so many African Americans, and again, this is not scientific, it's anecdotal, just response, if so many are against this, I have to really be very careful about being sensitive to the feelings of so many people, particularly those that have suffered from violence, that are victim violence survivors. I have to be sensitive to their feelings and their thoughts and their concerns.
From the standpoint of yourself and the people that you write about, try to put yourself in the shoes of Governor Schwarzenegger running for re-election next year as a Republican in California, where the death penalty has been a major political issue from time to time. What do you think he's going through?
Well, I think at this point in time, he's being pushed and pulled. I think he's being tugged by, buffeted by a lot of political forces. Let me just say this, Warren. I think it's going to be a political decision, whether it's yay or nay on clemency. Ultimately, at the end of the day, two things Governor Schwarzenegger has to look at. One, he's a Republican. This is a Democratic state. He's up for a tough reelection bid in 2006. Is he going to get any political brownie points by granting clemency from the California Republican Party, which he needs? No. It's a very conservative party. obviously a law and order party. They're not for clemency. The second thing is, as you well know, governors anyway are loath to get involved in the clemency process, the appeals process. They don't want to get involved with condemned killers anyway, simply because they feel, look, they've been convicted, they've committed heinous crimes, it's gone through every level of state and federal appellate review. The people have spoken, we're not going to get involved. So I think these two political factors are going to weigh very heavily on Schwarzenegger's decision. Finally, one other thing, Warren. I think at the end of the day, Schwarzenegger will have to ask the question and get an answer. Did Tukey Williams really accept responsibility for crimes that he's been convicted of? I know there's questions about guilt or innocence, but he's a convicted murderer. Did he apologize, accept responsibility and culpability? You know and I know he hasn't, and he refuses to because he says he didn't do it.
So that obviously will play a part. If the governor, of course, is looking for political support in the other direction, which he might be doing in a Democratic state, as far as the African-American community is concerned, from what you've said, he might come out 50-50.
No, I don't agree, Warren. I'll tell you why. It doesn't make any difference if Arnold Schwarzenegger did handstands at the NAACP convention for the next 20 years. He's not going to get the African-American vote. So that's a lost cause anyway. Clemency for Tukey Williams is not going to make that any more favorable toward him.
All right. The governor, of course, like other governors, insists this is not a political decision. It is one of the most agonizing personal decisions that any politician would have to make. Earl Afari Hutchinson, as always, good to have you on our program.
Take care, Warren. Bye.
Today's program produced by Sharon Rembaum with Katie Cooper and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.